Hello and welcome to Discern This, a podcast that aims to create a better understanding of global issues. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. As the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza rocks the Middle East, repercussions echo right here in the United States. Aid to both Israelis and Palestinians is being challenged. The Biden administration is trying to show a link between aid to Ukraine and aid to Israel, arguing both are in the U.S. national interest. Meantime, on college campuses and city streets, pro-Palestinian protesters shout at their pro-Israeli counterparts. Some liberal U.S. Jews feel betrayed by the left. "We supported your causes," they say, "but now you won't join in our support for Israel, despite Hamas's vicious killing and hostage-taking of innocent civilians on October the 7th. We're joined today by Joel Rubin, who describes himself as a pragmatic progressive. He's a national security expert who served as a deputy assistant secretary of state during the Obama administration. Mr. Rubin is a liberal activist, Jewish community leader, and local elected official, and he's thrown his hat into the ring for Maryland's 6th district race for the U.S. Congress next year. Hello and welcome, Joel.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
We're going to get to all of that and more, but first I want to just hear, what is your view about how the Biden administration is handling the conflict in Gaza?
Well, you know, Jim, this conflict at this moment is so tied to American national security that the way the president has engaged has been incredibly sharp and proactive. And President Biden understands quite well that in the United States does not have total control over the adversaries here, neither over the Israelis or the Palestinians, but that we really do have national security interests in the region. We don't want to see a war spread out beyond Israel and Gaza and Hamas. And so for the United States, being proactive with the diplomacy has been crucial, not only to assure our allies and friends in the region that we're watching and that we're there, but also to provide some deterrence to potential bad actors, to Iran, to Hezbollah, to those who may want to take advantage of this moment to try to get involved and create a broader conflict. And then I think one other thing to add, which is really important, is that the president, he understands the mindset of Israel and the Israelis. And early on, he leaned in a very pro-Israel argument about America supports Israel. And that has bought him some political equities inside of Jerusalem to argue for taking care to not harm Palestinian civilians, to really try to create some contours around this conflict as we head into what will likely be a very intense ground invasion. So I'm giving him an A+.
All right, but there still are very real fears this could be a wider conflict and draw the U.S. into another Middle East conflict, and most people don't want any part of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, I served as a career officer at the State Department early in my career. I was in our bureau that handled the Middle East during the Bush administration and saw front row and center what it looks like when a country goes to war that it doesn't need to go to and then gets caught in a quagmire. We took our eye off the ball there. We got into this Iraq invasion that really undermined our ability to go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the American people suffered. Thousands of soldiers were killed. Iraqis, in the case of Iraq, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of casualties. A disaster by all measures. And the Middle East is punishing. It's brutal. And just when you think you're getting out, as I think the United States thought it was, as they say in The Godfather 3, right, they pulls you back in. And here it is again. This administration, like others, was essentially grappling with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and didn't quite know how to manage it in a way to resolve it. And now we see the result is that when the United States, when others, when there's no real pressure to resolve that conflict, it explodes. And so now we're pulled back in. And thankfully, no American troops are involved in this in the way that was recklessly done during the Bush administration. But all that said, we do have a lot of our people in the region in the front lines, which is also very concerning.
And there's been an uptick in attacks on U.S. troops in other parts of the Middle East. All of these things are concerns. And President Biden is urging Prime Minister Netanyahu to slow things down and think. Good advice?
This is the kind of advice that only a best friend can provide. You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu lost credibility. It was just be direct about it. Lost credibility inside of Israel in his ability to provide security for the state of Israel as a result of this attack. There were always concerns about his management throughout Israeli politics, just like there are here in the United States. But what we've seen in the past 6 to 9 months was a real clash between the prime minister and the national security establishment of Israel due to his push for judicial changes to the judicial system. Judicial coup is what I would call it. And then this disastrous attack on October 7th. And even this morning when we heard the Israeli hostage release, this 85-year-old grandmother, it didn't take long for her to come out and criticize the Israeli Defense Forces and their inability to protect the southern border. So, you know, President Biden, he sees that. And then he also sees how important it is to the Israeli people to have the United States coming in and saying that we're going to have your back and sending our aircraft carrier groups to the Eastern Mediterranean to kind of put a watch on there. And I think that gives the space now for his experts, in particular Secretary of Defense Austin, who fought in Iraq, who understands how to command in a counterinsurgency type of forum, and going into Mosul, for example, and defeating ISIS, and how hard of a slog that is. And so the United States, by whispering in the ear directly to Netanyahu and his leadership team, is saying, we have experience, we know what we're doing, you have taken some lumps here, you need to listen to us. And I think this is a very important, unexpected role that the United States is now playing.
Well, you know, as I look at it, when I see what is going on in Gaza, and you see the media war, and that's what it is. Hamas has launched that, the release of some hostages, but not all the hostages, the calls for a ceasefire, all of that aside, does Israel really have a plan on what to do with Gaza? Say they succeed. You know, it's never worked before. You know, Joel, we both heard this time and again. This time we're really going to do it. We're going to completely eliminate these people. Hasn't worked before. And then what? Even if you are successful.
You know, Jim, if you go back over the decades of Israeli-Gaza relations, to put it in that bucket, going back to prime ministers like Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, trying to figure out how to dislodge and disconnect Israel from Gaza. Go back earlier during the Camp David negotiations, peace between Israel and Egypt. Israel said to Egypt, you can have it, take it. And Egypt said, no, thank you. It's yours. You control it. You keep it. And then Rabin, fast forwarding to the initial moves on the Oslo peace process, was what we called Gaza Jericho, basically bringing back Yasser Arafat from Tunis to govern Gaza because the Israelis didn't want to. And so time and again, this has been an incredibly impossible political military challenge for Israel. And when they left in 05, 06 and departed from the ground, no Israeli has wanted to go back. After pulling out settlements from there, and Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, basically walking away and wiping his hands, said, here, Palestinian Authority, you can have it. And Israel has not wanted to reassert itself on the ground for good reason. And I fear, and you look at the data and you look at the reality that in Mosul, it took nearly 9 months to dislodge the Islamic State, who had only been encamped there for about a year to 2 years of really digging in. We now have Hamas controlling Gaza for 15, 16 years without interruption. And Gaza is much denser than Mosul. And it has the potential to be a very, very bloody, difficult fight. And the network of tunnels underground, the list goes on and on. So there is a level of damaging the capacity of Hamas to launch military assaults And what's the achievable objective there versus complete regime change and decapitation of the entirety of the enterprise of Hamas? Is that viable? Is that possible? And then the day after, who controls the physical space of Gaza with any legitimacy with the population to enable a political transition to some type of stable civilian, non-hostile government? These are major questions, and there are no easy answers.
Well, you know, outside forces, the UN, that's not going to happen. I don't think even Israel wants the UN in there. Mm-hmm. But Egypt, Jordan, all of the surrounding countries that do have relations with Israel, they don't want to be going into Gaza. They don't want to take over. And you could argue that, yes, there's the Palestinian Authority, but it is probably in its weakest state in its history. You know, it's a very difficult job. And Israel doesn't seem to have a clear answer.
And I don't think anybody has a clear answer. And that's the biggest challenge here, right? I mean, nobody has the best, clearest answer for how to demilitarize and pacify the political objectives of the leaders that continue to come from Gaza that want to attack Israel. And there are clearly objectives politically through diplomatic process, some type of rapprochement between Israel and the Palestinians, some type of peace agreement to a certain extent. But remember, Hamas, they're spoilers. And the challenge here is that Hamas, it has a nihilistic approach to the world. It, tear it all down is their mindset. And when you hear the interviews of the leadership, they cite the millions of people who have been killed around the world in resistance. And as if it's not a problem, fine, we'll lose our population, tens of thousands. That's what it will cost. So when you have that, you have to dislodge that, but physically, incredibly difficult. And I think to your point, Arab states for a moment may be willing to pitch in, but putting boots on the ground, I'm incredibly skeptical that they would do that. I would believe that they would look at Israel and say, you know, like Colin Powell said, you break it, you buy it. And if Israel goes in and takes control of Gaza, they're going to likely have to reoccupy to a significant extent. But then, of course, try to help the Palestinian Authority would be my guess. And this is just based upon, you know, looking at the conflict, help the Palestinian Authority to reassert itself into that space, a space that it was kicked out of by Hamas. This is very complex. So the Israelis probably can only tell the United States and others that our goal really is to just prevent and eliminate Hamas's military capacity to ever strike us again. The political dimensions, I don't think anybody can give a clear answer to at this moment.
I think you're right about that. We have to watch this, and we could be months away still from any resolution here or a clear idea of what is going to happen.
That's right.
But I think that the U.S. is being very careful not to dictate any terms to Israel, and I think it's working. I think Biden's strategy is working. Still, progressives in the Democratic Party, your party, you know, on the far left, now, you know, calling for a ceasefire.
Yeah.
And Biden coming out and saying that no, not until the hostages are all free.
Well, President Biden's in good company. President Obama is in the same position, saying the same position, offering words of caution to Israel, but not calling for a ceasefire. That would undermine President Biden's ability to influence the situation. He went through this a couple of years ago when there was a major flare-up between Israel and Hamas in the spring of 2021, and he held for 5 or 6 days before calling for a ceasefire. So I think this idea of wait and see, let's see what develops on the ground, is really important. And he understands that he also has major political equities. And I'll go back to this point. It matters what the Israeli public thinks. The Israeli public, they are the ones in the fighting forces. They are the ones that vote in this Israeli democracy. And so what President Biden is doing is he's putting the onus on Israel and on its decision makers to figure out what to do next while gently offering them support, not making the United States the center of attention. And I also think, frankly, that he understands if he were to call for a ceasefire, that doesn't mean it would work at all. And he would take heat here politically perhaps for no actual execution of what he's calling for. So he's trying to shape it. And in this interim process, as Israel gets pushed with the hard questions, he is able to secure gains for humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians, which is not a small gain. Israel was not going down that road until the president intervened in providing $100 million in assistance. And so to the base of the Democratic Party, it's wholly unsatisfying. And that's understandable because, like me, like most people, they don't want to see war. They don't want to see conflict. They want to see the killings end. The problem is that Israel is sitting next to an ISIS cell with massive firepower that just attacked and killed several thousand of its people. And it's impossible to tell Israel that they just need to deal with it and not respond. What he's trying to do is shape that response. But that pressure is real. I just want to add that is influencing the base of the Democratic Party, and it is having an impact on the dialogue. There is some value in having the broader Overton window, so to speak, to give the president some space to then push harder on humanitarian assistance. But I'm not sure that's why they're doing it. I do believe that it really is a call for a direct ceasefire, not to try to provide some additional leverage for the president when he talks to the Israelis.
I want to turn now, because you're an activist, a longtime progressive, you've been involved in promoting all kinds of causes for that wing of the Democratic Party, if you will. And now suddenly we see the demonstrations on college campuses, Harvard, the calls for an immediate ceasefire and placing all the blame on Israel.
Yeah.
Is it feeling a little bit lonely to be Jewish and progressive today?
Well, we are not alone in our loneliness, because there are a lot of people like me right now in the Jewish community who are publicly expressing deep concerns and dismay, quite frankly. You know, I grew up in Pittsburgh. Just about a few days from now will be the fifth anniversary of the mass murders in the Tree of Life Synagogue in my neighborhood in Squirrel Hill. My parents were there the night before the murders for Shabbat services on a Friday night. And 5 years later, fast forward now, mass slaughter of Jews, the single largest number of Jews killed since the Holocaust in any one single event. And so for the Jewish world, it feels like the walls are closing in on us. We have white supremacists, and then we have extremist anti-Israel terrorists. And for the Jewish community in the United States, we have built alliances across different communities. They call it intersectionality. That's a term that's used in the progressive space of trying to find overlapping points of interest to advocate for progressive outcomes. And the Jewish community has been a very active player in that. And on October 7th, when the murders were happening in Israel, the concerns that many people who I am close to in the Jewish world were that we were not being reached out to in any manner at all by individuals saying that is a horrible thing, what's happening. There was silence from many of those partners and those allies. And that's stuck, that initial 48 hours of quiet before Israel really responded in anything. These humanitarian issues we're now talking about, it was that quiet that made American Jewish liberals feel quite alone and concerned about our real standing right now.
Feeling betrayed?
Say that again, betrayed? Betrayal.
It's a strong word, but
I would say the key word is feeling despair might be the word. A sense of aloneness, and it's
what is it? Mm-hmm. What is it that they don't get, the students don't get? I mean, when you look at the events of October the 7th,
yeah.
Joel, I don't see any way to describe them other than a textbook example of war crimes and violations, the real violations of human rights.
So I'm in this interesting space in my life. I am 52. I'll admit it in public. And so I have the benefit of getting a real long perspective of humans that are part of my family. My great grandparents, I knew my grandparents very well, and I have young daughters. So span the living memory now is well over 100 years. My memory of youth and growing up in the Jewish world is survival from the Holocaust, near extinction as the Jewish people, and a resurgence and revitalization of our community through the establishment of the State of Israel and acceptance here in the United States as equal Americans. That's my worldview, and that's one that I truly believe is healthy for my community's survival. There were 18 million Jews in the world before World War II. There are now 15 million. We still have not recovered from that trauma. And so that's an historic perspective that matters. And it matters to the psyche of Jews, American Jews, people who are committed to the State of Israel and liberal ideals. And I think that's been lost. You know, a lot of the language that I see now talking about Israel, the critics love to use Nazi analogs and genocide as a term to go after Israel and the Jewish community. And there's no way, shape, or form that I'm going to diminish the pain, suffering, and humanitarian losses of the Palestinian people. I've been fighting for Middle East peace my entire career. I helped to found organizations that are dedicated to that. But this is not appropriate to say to the Jewish community. This is an intent, this intentionally damages relations and undermines the ability to work together. And what's happening is that it is shrinking the broad tent of the progressive community where American Jews who support Israel are feeling excluded from the progressive community now in a way that some days ago we were not, or it was tenuous. And that is dangerous for the overall objective of liberalism in America, of commitment to democracy and pluralism.
You know, when I interact right here in my own neighborhood, and I'm sure this happens to you as well, people come to you and they say, "Explain this to me. You know, I just don't get it." They don't know, they ask, "Why has it taken so long to get the Palestinians some rights?" Now, you used to work right there in the Congress, and you know it well, but you also know that probably the least popular politician in Israel today had a big role to play.
Look, I mean, the Israeli policy towards the Palestinians has been nothing short of a dramatic failure, and it has not provided security to the Israelis nor justice to the Palestinians. The settlement enterprise, the continual promotion of colonization, settlement of the West Bank, these are hindering and have hindered the ability of Israel to negotiate a legitimate two-state solution with the Palestinians and created a climate of conditions of conflict. That does not excuse, and this is where we will always find the political challenge here in the U.S. That does not excuse terrorism. I am a major opponent of what Hamas did. In fact, in the 90s, when there was a peace process underway and Shimon Peres was negotiating and was the prime minister of Israel after having won a Nobel Peace Prize, Hamas went in to Tel Aviv and committed suicide bombings and blew up dozens of Israelis to try to kill the peace process. That is a horrible part of the
Well,
coin.
it was a scenario that was
It's a
repeated over and
scenario.
over again.
And quite frankly, they may well have taken the initiative now because they were worried about increasing normalization of Israel into the Middle East. It's quite possible. They are human beings and they understand strategy too. But when we look at the Israeli policies towards the Palestinians, they have not offered hope in recent years. And I'm not saying this in a vacuum. There are many Israeli leaders. I once went to a conference in Herzliya in Israel in 2010, and Ehud Barak, the most decorated soldier in the history of Israel, got up and said at this security conference, "If we don't make peace, there will be apartheid." That's Ehud Barak's words, not mine. This is not crazy talk. This is People who care about Israel's long-term survival and security understand that peace is the best way to guarantee it. And now we're seeing the lack of peace, the dynamics that can flow when one has insecure borders and an unsettled situation with the Palestinians.
We're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks to Joel Rubin for sharing his thoughts and his emotions at this difficult time. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Discern This, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening in on iTunes or Spotify. If you like these kinds of discussions of global issues, give us a like, follow us. For now, so long. I'm Jim Clancy.